Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Today's chapter is Epilogue 1, Chapter 12. As in every large household, there were at Bald Hills several perfectly distinct worlds which merged into one harmonious whole, though each retained its own peculiarities and made concessions to the others. Every event, joyful or sad, that took place in that house was important to all these worlds, but each had its own special reasons to rejoice or grieve over that occurrence, independently of the others. For instance, Pierre's return was a joyful and important event, and they all felt it to be so. The servants, the most reliable judges of their masters, because they judge not by their conversation or expressions of feeling, but by their acts and way of life, were glad of Pierre's return because they knew that when he was there Count Nicholas would cease going every day to attend to the estate and would be in kinder spirits and temper, and also because they would all receive handsome presents for the holidays. The children and their governesses were glad of Pierre's return because no one else drew them into the social life of the household as he did. He alone could play on the clavichord that écossaise, his only piece, to which, as he said, all possible dances could be danced, and they felt sure he had brought presents for them all. Young Nicholas, now a slim lad of 15, delicate and intelligent, with curly, light brown hair and beautiful eyes, was delighted because Uncle Pierre, as he called him, was the object of his rapturous and passionate affection. No one had instilled into him this love for Pierre, whom he only saw occasionally. Countess Mary, who had brought him up, had done her utmost to make him love her husband, as she loved him, and little Nicholas did love his uncle, but loved him with just a shade of contempt. Pierre, however, he adored. He did not want to be a hussar or a knight of St. George, like his uncle Nicholas. He wanted to be learned, wise, and kind, like Pierre. In Pierre's presence, his face always shone with pleasure, and he flushed and was breathless when Pierre spoke to him. He did not miss a single word he uttered, and would afterwards, with de Sales or by himself, recall and reconsider the meaning of everything Pierre had said. Pierre's past life and his unhappiness prior to 1812, of which young Nicholas had formed a vague poetic picture from some words he had overheard, his adventures in Moscow, his captivity, Platon Karatayev, of whom he had heard from Pierre, his love for Natasha, of whom the lad was also particularly fond, and especially Pierre's friendship with the father whom Nicholas could not remember. All this made Pierre, in his eyes, a hero and a saint. From broken remarks about Natasha and his father, from the emotion with which Pierre spoke of that dead father, and from the careful, reverent tenderness with which Natasha spoke of him, the boy, who was only just beginning to guess what love is, derived the notion that his father had loved Natasha, and when dying had left her to his friend. But the father whom the boy did not remember appeared to him a divinity who could not be pictured, and of whom he never thought without a swelling heart and tears of sadness and rapture. So the boy also was happy that Pierre had arrived. The guests welcomed Pierre because he always helped to enliven and unite any company he was in. The grown-up members of the family, not to mention his wife, were pleased to have back a friend whose presence made life run more smoothly and peacefully. The old ladies were pleased with the presents he brought them, and especially that Natasha would now be herself again. Pierre felt the different outlooks of those various worlds and made haste to satisfy all their expectations. Though the most absent-minded and forgetful of men, Pierre, with the aid of a list his wife drew up, had now bought everything, not forgetting his mother and brother-in-law's commissions, nor the dress material for a present to Belova, nor the toys for his wife's nephews. In the early days of his marriage, it had seemed strange to him that his wife should expect him not to forget to procure all the things he undertook to buy, and he had been taken aback by her serious annoyance when on his first trip he forgot everything. But in time he grew used to this demand, knowing that Natasha asked nothing for herself and only gave him commissions for others when he himself had offered to undertake them. He now found an unexpected and childlike pleasure in this purchase of presents for everyone in the house, and never forgot anything. If he now incurred Natasha's censure, it was only for buying too many and too expensive things. To her other defects, as most people thought them, but which to Pierre were qualities, of untidiness and neglect of herself, she now added stinginess. From the time that Pierre began life as a family man on a footing entailing heavy expenditure, he had noticed to his surprise that he spent only half as much as before, and that his affairs, which had been in disorder of late, chiefly because of his first wife's debts, had begun to improve. Life was cheaper because it was circumscribed. That most expensive luxury, the kind of life that can be changed at any moment, was no longer his, nor did he wish for it. He felt that his way of life had now been settled once for all, till death, and that to change it was not in his power, and so that way of life proved economical. With a merry, smiling face, Pierre was sorting his purchases. "What do you think of this?" he said, unrolling a piece of stuff like a shopman. Natasha, who was sitting opposite to him with her eldest daughter on her lap, turned her sparkling eyes swiftly from her husband to the things he showed her. "That's for Belova. Excellent." She felt the quality of the material. "It was a ruble and arshin, I suppose." Pierre told her the price. "Too dear," Natasha remarked. "How pleased the children will be, and Mama too. Only you need not have bought me this," she added, unable to suppress a smile as she gazed admiringly at a gold comb set with pearls of a kind then just coming into fashion. "Adele tempted me. She kept on telling me to buy it," returned Pierre. "When am I to wear it?" And Natasha stuck it in her coil of hair. "When I take little Masha into society. Perhaps they will be fashionable again by then. Well, let's go now." And collecting the presents, they went first to the nursery and then to the old countess's rooms. The countess was sitting with her companion Belova, playing grand patience as usual, when Pierre and Natasha came into the drawing room with parcels under their arms. The countess was now over 60. Was quite grey and wore a cap with a frill that surrounded her face. Her face had shrivelled, her upper lip had sunk in, and her eyes were dim. After the deaths of her son and husband in such rapid succession, she felt herself a being accidentally forgotten in this world, and left without aim or object for her existence. She ate, drank, slept, or kept awake, but did not live. Life gave her no new impressions. She wanted nothing from life but tranquility, and that tranquility only death could give her. But until death came, she had to go on living. That is, to use her vital forces. A peculiarity one sees in very young children and very old people was particularly evident in her. Her life had no external aims. Only a need to exercise her various functions and an inclination was apparent. She had to eat, sleep, think, speak, weep, work, give vent to her anger, and so on, merely because she had a stomach, a brain, muscles, nerves, and a liver. She did these things not under any external impulses, as people in the full vigour of life do when behind the aim for which they strive, the other aim of exercising their functions, remains unnoticed. She talked only because she physically needed to exercise her tongue and lungs. She cried as a child does because her nose had to be cleared and so on. What for people in their full vigour is an aim was for her evidently merely a pretext. Thus, in the morning, especially if she had eaten anything rich the day before, she felt a need of being angry, and would choose as the handiest pretext Belova's deafness. She would begin to say something to her in a low tone from the other end of the room. "It seems a little warmer today, my dear," she would murmur. And when Belova replied, "Oh yes, they've come," she would mutter angrily, "Oh Lord, how stupid and deaf she is." Another pretext would be her snuff, which would seem too dry or too damp or not rubbed fine enough. After these fits of irritability, her face would grow yellow, and her maids knew by infallible symptoms that when Belova would again be deaf, the snuff damp, and the Countess's face yellow. Just as she needed to work off her spleen, so she had sometimes to exercise her still existing faculty of thinking. And the pretext for that was a game of patience. When she needed to cry, the deceased count would be the pretext. When she wanted to be agitated, Nicholas and his health would be the pretext. And when she felt a need to speak spitefully, the pretext would be Countess Mary. When her vocal organs needed exercise, which was usually towards 7 o'clock, when she had had an after-dinner rest in a darkened room, the pretext would be the retelling of the same stories over and over again to the same audience. The old lady's condition was understood by the whole household, though no one ever spoke of it, and they all made every possible effort to satisfy her needs. Only by a rare glance exchanged with a sad smile between Nicholas, Pierre, Natasha, and Countess Mary was the common understanding of her condition expressed. But those glances expressed something more. They said that she had played her part in life, that what they now saw was not her whole self, that we must all become like her, and that they were glad to yield to her, to restrain themselves for this once precious being, formerly as full of life as themselves, but now so much to be pitied. "Memento mori," said these glances. Only the real heartless, the stupid ones of that household, and the little children failed to understand this and avoided her. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Just quickly, doing an advertisement. This podcast is supported by Audible. Audible.com. Audibletrial.com, I should say. If you'd like to check out Audible's unrivaled lineup of audiobooks. It's an app you get on your phone and you can just listen to audiobooks all day long. You can get a free 1 month subscription by going to audibletrial.com/ander. And included with that free 1 month trial subscription is any audiobook of your choosing from their catalog. So audibletrial.com/ander. Thank you kindly for your patience. Now, on with the show. This was a nice chapter. Kind of touching, kind of bittersweet. I really liked learning that little Nikolai, baby Nikolai, is 15? Was it 15? How crazy. I can feel like I can remember his birth like it was yesterday when his poor mother... she didn't make it through that. I don't know, it was just really cool, and I didn't realize it had been 15 years in the book since that moment, but wow, there you go. De Fleury said, "It's mid-December, and I've got a new favorite character, baby Nicholas." All right, he's 15. Is that the same as Petya? I think that's, nearly the same as Petya. How old was Petya when he died? He was just a teenager. De Fleury said, "He wants to be learned, wise, and kind. In other words, a Jedi, like his father before him. And I approve wholeheartedly." Yeah. Yeah, he's awesome. I really like this character. We need a sequel. War and Peace 2. Tradana said, I fell pretty far behind and I'm just catching up. I really liked the part in this chapter about Nikolenka. He's kind of like Andrei's presence in the epilogue. I didn't really question his dislike of Nikolai much, as I think Andrei didn't like him very much either. I could be misremembering, so it kind of made sense to me. Haha. Yeah, well, Andrei and Nikolai did have a bit of a, not a falling out, but they met when they were both away at war, and it didn't go over too well for Nikolai. Andrei basically called him out for being a show-off. I think it was something like that. Who Was Once Delight said, Tolstoy says that the servants are the most reliable judges of their masters because they judge not by conversations and expressions of feelings, but by acts and manner of life. Do you think this is true? Do you think there is a modern equivalent of this kind of judge of persons, of a person's character? You know, I really don't know, actually. Let me read that again. They don't judge by conversations and expressions of feelings, but by acts and manner of life. Well, I'm a big advocate for the whole actions speak louder than words thing. And I believe that on a sort of deep level, that, you know, it's something that you hear your whole life as a kid, actions speak louder than words, but that the way people act is who they are, not the things that they say. So conversations and expressions of feelings, well, in a conversation or someone expressing themselves, people are always going to be, they want people to like them, don't they? They want to be nice. So even if they're being mean because, like, they're bickering about someone else who's in the wrong and they are in the right. But talk is cheap, you know, and it's what you do that defines who you are or who you were. Not so much what you said. So I suppose these servants, being outside of the conversation, they just make their judgments based on what other people doing. What are their masters doing? Not so much what are they saying. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's a modern equivalent, but I reckon there's definitely some truth in there. Who Was Once Delight said also, what do you think of Nikolenka's admiration of Pierre and the barely noticeable shade of contempt he holds for Nikolai Rostov? Are these feelings deserved? Are they understandable? I really like that Nikolenka gets along so well with Pierre for all the reasons that were listed in the book itself. That he was friends with Nikolenka's father. That he's wise and learned and so many reasons. But, yeah, I think that's really cool. And I can kind of see them getting along, you know, for the rest of their lives sort of thing. Little bromance, although that's maybe a weird term to call it when it's your uncle. Are they deserved and are they understandable, these feelings? I think the feelings towards Pierre are definitely deserved and understandable. The barely noticeable shade of contempt he holds for Nikolai Rostov, probably also a little bit deserved, and certainly understandable, because Nikolai, he seems a bit coarse in his old age. Not that he's super old. I think he'd be 30 something though by now, and he seems to have gotten a bit gruff. So I could see why, you know, a young man wouldn't really look up to someone who seems a bit too stern and a bit too maybe even cruel in some aspects. Tolstoy also notes that Pierre's life was cheaper because it was restricted, says Who Was Once Delight. He no longer had that most expensive luxury, which is the kind of life that can be changed at any moment. How does this go with Pierre's thoughts and experience as a prisoner of war? Do you think his life is richer with more or fewer options in it? I think his life is certainly richer. I think as a young man, there was a lot of uncertainty, which feeds into that kind of life that can be changed at any moment. When you're young, you're a lot more spontaneous, but that spontaneity is expensive, right? But, you know, when you settle down, so to speak, your life definitely becomes richer. I think that that's a sentiment that's really echoed through any of your, like, older... well, I was going to say your older family, but just people who are older than you in general, they'll all tell you that. You know, people who have retired and had families and had careers, they'll all say, once you settle down and start a family and stop living that crazy young lifestyle, that life becomes a lot richer, more rewarding. So, hey, old people must know, right? They've experienced both things, being young and being old, so they are really the only authority on who can tell you that kind of advice. Jen Whatup said, I too loved this chapter. I enjoyed seeing Pierre and Natasha through little Nicholas's eyes, and the description of the old countess was moving, as my mother is in her late 60s, and that's all I could think about. It was spot on. I thought it was really quite touching, that last bit about Countess, old Countess Rostova. But late 60s seems early for that sort of aimlessness to be setting on. Like, her whole life was just about going through the motions. I think the loss of her son and of her husband brought that on prematurely. And I'm really sorry to hear, Jen, what up, that you find that relatable in the case of your own mother. But I could definitely relate to it by thinking about my great-grandmother and sort of like the last, I don't know, years of her life sort of thing. Once she'd really become like in the end game of her life, and it was clear that, you know, she was being nursed every day and being looked after. So that's what I was thinking about in that chapter. Like, and the thing I loved about it is that all the people, except for the kids and the stupid people, all the people made an effort to keep her included and to keep being sort of polite and nice to her, even if she was kind of becoming a bit bitter and mean and, you know, a bit of a downer. Because, that's what you get. That's the reward for living into old age. It's like you've paid your dues and now people can look after you until you're ready to check out. I think that's a pretty fair deal. So I think every young person with any sense at all, first of all, they respect the memory of who that person was before their mind started deteriorating. And also they kind of honor the fact that one day they will be in that situation, and you hope that people will be kind to you when it happens to you. So it's like almost like a paying it forward thing, and you have that understanding that, well, at some point Countess Rostova would have been young and she would have been kind to her elders. Respect your elders. That's something that I think is it's a essential bit of society. Respect for your elders. I've recently upped my game with respect for elders. In the last few years of my life, because you know, when I was a teenager, there was just like not really old people in my life, and so old people were just funny old people. You know, I was a teenager, so you can forgive me for being a bit of an asshole. But then you wise up, don't you? And then, whenever I see an old man, I'll call him sir, you know, that kind of thing. Someone said recently, I can't remember who said this to me, or if I read it online or read it on Reddit or something, but they said, The reason old people move so slowly is because it's painful to move, is because they're in pain. And that just made me kind of go, oh man, that's got to be true. Like, you just think they move slow because they're old, but no, they're actually feeling pain, right? So be nice to old people. The other thing, the last thing I'll mention about this chapter that I really liked, was that Pierre is unbroken, right? People, all these people have changed and become bitter or become frumpy, as some of the Reddit users have said about Natasha, or, you know, they've kind of lost their sense of humor. But Pierre has kind of kept himself, right? Stayed positive. And that's sort of through effort that he put into his own development, right? Like, he went out and he seeked, like, enlightenment, I suppose you could say. He put himself in situations where he wanted to see the truth of the world. He wanted to know what it was like to be sort of a no one, you know, life without privilege, and all these things. So he put in the effort to develop himself, and he did a good job, because he's really the only person of these surviving characters who is in good spirits. And I think that is completely owed to the effort that he put in. All right, going to end the episode there. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.